welcome to the Hooked on Health podcast. I am your host, Dr. Sean Lorden. I am the author of Stop Aging in Its Tracks and the owner of Concierge Physical Therapy, a sports medicine physical therapy practice with multiple locations in Massachusetts. Please sit back and enjoy the show.
All right, so welcome to the Hooked on Health podcast. Today we've got two special guests. So we've got Dr. Samantha Santiago, of Concierge PT, a women's health specialist here, and Dr. Kristen Hung over at MGH. And Kristen, I'll let you dive into your credentials and tell us a little bit about what you do and who you help.
Sure. It's nice to meet everyone. As Sean said, I'm Kristen Hung. I am a practicing urogynecologist at Mass General Hospital. What that means is that I treat women with pelvic floor disorders, and I'll get into that a little bit later. I am originally trained and board certified as an OBGYN, and I completed my female pelvic medicine and reconstructive surgery fellowship at Mass General, where I stayed on as faculty. Have been really happy there and feel really lucky to have the opportunity to help women with issues mostly relating to urinary incontinence, which has a lot of causes, as well as pelvic organ prolapse, which has a lot of causes and solutions as well. Generally speaking, pelvic floor disorders encompasses a lot more than that, but those are the two most common reasons people come to see me.
Excellent. Cool. So, you know, I think the biggest question, you know, maybe somebody who's new to medicine might have is, what's the difference between an OBGYN and a urogynecologist? Can you dive into that a little bit?
That's a really good question. So an OBGYN is someone who delivers babies, does pap smears, and takes care of routine gynecologic health. So anyone who is involved in the prenatal care and delivering babies has been trained as an OBGYN. Anyone who wants to further their training and specifically focus a little, you know, away from the delivering babies part and onto specific issues in the pelvic floor, then goes on to do a fellowship in female pelvic medicine and reconstructive surgery. Because that is a mouthful, we call that in layman's terms urogynecology, or I'm a urogynecologist. What that really means in the nitty-gritty is that we take care of women who have pelvic floor disorders, and so we practice female pelvic medicine. One of the things that is required for some women is also reconstructing things that childbirth and life in general and potentially genetic dispositions have caused. And that's where the reconstructive surgery part comes in. So we do a lot of surgery, and we are pelvic floor surgeons, but that's not all we do.
Great. So what are the most, you know, and I think this is probably one of our questions, but what are the top conditions that you treat and that you see often?
So the most common conditions that I treat, like I said, are urinary incontinence. There are a lot of types of urinary incontinence, and there are a lot of causes and solutions. So most people coming in will broadly say, you know, I leak urine, or the urine comes out when I don't want it to. But drilling down as to what's causing that and what's the best solution is a big part of what I do. The other big part of what I do and takes up a lot of my time is the prolapse part. And that's where the reconstructive surgery comes in. Prolapse means that things fall down. That's the general definition of prolapse. What's falling down is another question. And so pelvic organ prolapse is when the organs inside the pelvis, mostly it means bladder, rectum, bowels, and just all that potential space. Everything is just piled on top of each other inside in the pelvic floor. And so when things fall down, people are not necessarily sure what organs are falling down. It's important to note that it's not a problem necessarily with the organs themselves. It's the supports that used to hold up the pelvic floor structures that have failed. And so that's what we are reconstructing.
Great. So I think that's a nice, you know, jumping point to jump in with Dr. Sam is, you know, let's talk about the pelvic floor and this, the fascial slings and things like that. And let's talk about the role of, you know, how you work in tandem, you know, often with conservative care And, you know, kind of dive in, and you guys can kind of just take this one and run. But, you know, as a layman looking into it, you know, I'd love to know, you know, when you're thinking surgery and when you're thinking, hey, let's go with PT for a little while. Let's talk to Dr. Sam and see what she can do and strengthen. Why don't you guys talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So hello, Dr. Hung. I guess one question before I kind of dive in is, did you go into med school knowing that this is what you were going to end up doing? Or is this something that over the course of schooling, you've ended up, you know, finding a passion for and then continuing it? Now, I guess you're teaching. So that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I should have added, I suppose I'm also on faculty at Harvard Medical School. And part of what that means is that faculty are involved in teaching trainees at all levels, including medical students who are just kind of learning everything about medicine, OBGYN residents who are focusing on just the obstetrics and gynecology aspect, and I contribute to their urogynecology learning. And then I also have fellows in my own program that we are dedicated to teaching. We have one a year, it's very selective, and those are the people we're training to do what we do. So your question, do you mind repeating it to make sure I actually answer it?
Oh, no, yeah, no problem at all. I was just wondering, how did you end up?
Oh, for me specifically. So I did go into medical school wanting to be an OBGYN, and that's because I took some time for reflection and I actually worked in the field as an assistant and found that I really felt passionate about women's health and thought that I wanted to deliver babies for the rest of my life. I still miss that and I loved it, but I found urogynecology throughout the course of my residency training. The way my residency was set up, we didn't get exposed to it until towards the end of our training. And so it wasn't until later that I discovered the field of urogynecology and discovered that I was a really good match for it. Specifically, I learned that I was really good at surgery and really loved it and felt like that was something that I could use my skills to help people. Why urogynecology specifically rather than another surgical field within OBGYN has to do with what I realized I could contribute to help women. Pelvic floor disorders, particularly incontinence and prolapse, are quality of life problems. What this means is that it's not cancer. It's not going to shorten someone's life, but it is going to really damage their lives. And when you take away the quality of life, when you have these issues, a lot of women are very isolated. It feels, you know, a lot of things I hear from my patients are they feel ashamed. They feel alone. They feel like they cannot talk about this and that they cannot even tell their doctors. They certainly don't feel comfortable telling their partners and they don't even, you know, they don't want their kids to know. They don't want their parents to know. It's an incredibly isolating set of conditions. And knowing that there were concrete things that I could do to help people and make their lives better, it's a life-changing field. And I think that was really compelling for me to choose this to place my surgical skills and my clinical skills. The other thing I learned as I went on was that not everything is surgery, and we can help a lot of people without surgery. And I think that's the most important thing for people to keep in mind is that some things do need surgery, and for some people, that is the best approach. Mm-hmm. But the decision for that and when that happens really is the most important question for someone, and having a provider that can walk you through that is important. And I wanted to be able to do that for people.
Awesome. You definitely answered the question. And I think, you know, anyone listening here, this is a platform to, you know, bring up these conversations so that it isn't where it's, you know, the only approach is surgery, but there are some conservative treatments to try first. Like, and as you said, it's different for every person, but at least having that conversation with their primary care before seeing the, you know, last specialist and trying out other options. And the quality of life part, I think, is the biggest thing that I see on like the very early, very conservative end. Mm-hmm. So that's great that you address the quality of life, because I know some people listening might be saying, hey, that's me. I'm the type of person that if I go somewhere, I'm constantly looking for the bathroom, or the second my car is in the driveway and I have to run upstairs and can't turn the key fast enough to then use the restroom. So I know those are little habits that are common, but not normal. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
So with your practice, what general population do you see? Do you see more adult postpartum or do you see more older adult, maybe menopause age range, or do you see the entire spectrum?
That's a really important question. Thank you for asking it. I see the entire spectrum. I only see adults. So my patients are all mostly older, but we do have teens who come to see us referred by their pediatricians for different issues. The vast majority of people have had children, but not everyone needs to have children in order to have pelvic floor issues. For the most part, historically, these issues kind of build with age. And so we do see older patients as a trend. But the other thing that is a trend, luckily, is that these issues are becoming more well-known. And so women are learning either from their friends, from the media, and from programs such as this, that they can get help and that they can get better, and that this is not something that they have to live with. And so we are seeing women who are postpartum and very soon postpartum. I just saw a woman whose baby is 1 month old. And so what is most appropriate for each woman at different stages of her life and recovery is also something that's important to discuss with your physician.
Awesome. What helps you decide when someone is more suited for a conservative treatment versus a surgical intervention? Is that something that you'd have to discuss over, you know, the course of different appointments, or is that something that by the time they see you, it is surgery?
Depends on the patient. That is the most important question to ask for a lot of patients. And that takes up the bulk of my counseling with someone. Sometimes it's one conversation, sometimes it's 10. I have patients who are scheduled for surgery now that I've been seeing for 3 to 5 years. And now they're ready for surgery, both because they feel ready and because I determined that it's the best thing to do. That goes to say it is a joint decision and it is a team effort. There should never be a situation where someone tells you, you need surgery, just do the surgery. There should also never be a situation where someone tells me, I want surgery, do the surgery for me. And so it's a two-way street and it's an active conversation. And everyone will arrive to me coming from different backgrounds, different knowledge, and different other medical conditions. And so I take it all into consideration, and it's a very individualized approach that I take with each patient to determine what's the best next step and what's the best overall plan for them. And that plan can change as we go through the steps.
Yeah, sounds like you have very individualized care for each patient. So that's, you know, nothing's cookie cutter where it's a routine surgery, or not routine, I should say, but not everyone's coming to you for the same thing. So that's great to hear.
I'm just gonna jump in. You know, I think it's important to, you know, think about too, the decision tree before they even get to you, right? So I think a lot of times, maybe even the primary cares don't necessarily know that urogyno is potentially that path that a patient needs to go in. And there's, you know, how often do we see patients even orthopedically misdiagnosed, they go to, you know, different healthcare providers and they don't get the solutions they need, they end up here. I mean, think about low back pain, right? So we get plenty of patients with low back pain or you know, sciatica, right? So everybody comes in, and if they've got pain, they Google it and they come and they say they have sciatica, but it could potentially be a women's health issue. So I think just, you know, how many medications people potentially try or failed rehab they try before they come in to see you, Dr. Hung, could be really, you know, that's taking that pathway into consideration is something, you know, to consider, right? Because sometimes they're like, they're at the end of the funnel and they feel like, oh my gosh, you know, surgery is the only way, but that's not, you know, I think it's important for people to know that's not always the case.
Absolutely.
You know, that's cool.
I know you mentioned earlier with, so I have my pelvis here, which I don't know if it's going to be seen, but how once we take out the organs, and you were talking about prolapse, so those three organs, you know, fall down, or it's really this sling of muscles that get weakened, and then you get that, you know, gravity assisted, everything's falling down, especially when people are standing up, walking. So similar to how this is a group of muscles here in outpatient PT, I explain it that it's similar to a shoulder. It's a cuff of muscles. It's a group of muscles that when firing together acts as a great support. When one or two or even a few of them are not acting appropriately, we then see limited range of motion, pain, you know, dysfunction in movement. Similar to how we would prehab someone before a rotator cuff surgery or even a knee, have you worked with any outpatient or any prehab, I should say, first to improve outcomes for surgical intervention?
That's a really good question. There's actually been research done on this question, whether physical therapy and pelvic muscle exercises, generally speaking, improve outcomes of surgery, either done before or after surgery. I would have to say, you know, intuitively and anecdotally, PT never hurts, and it can only help. And I always tell people, you know, the only thing you're going to lose is time, you know, maybe your copay, but even then I think it's worth doing. So that's kind of how I practice, is that I feel like everyone can benefit from PT, and it's important to find a good therapist that's a good fit for you and that's well-trained. What the research shows us, though, is it's not necessarily that simple of a question. And again, it goes back to being individualized. There have been studies that looked at whether kind of doing PT before. And again, these studies aren't perfect. So what PT consists of varies. And a lot of the studies didn't so much have people go through a full formal course of PT, but rather had someone in clinic kind of teaching them some exercises and then having them do that. So that really, to me, is very different from sending someone to a physical therapist. And so I don't think I can quite generalize those studies. They didn't find a huge difference. They didn't find any harm. And I think that's important. But more importantly, it's not one size fits all, and not all Kegels doesn't mean physical therapy. And that's a common question I get when I tell patients about physical therapy. Often they ask, isn't that just Kegels? Why can't I do that on my own? And my answer is always the same. It's not just Kegels. Kegels done without supervision and improperly are going to make everything worse. And really, I would feel more comfortable, and I recommend that you do it under the supervision of a therapist who's specially trained in the pelvic floor. Even if your plan revolves around Kegels, you still need to go to PT. And actually, for a lot of people, it's not just Kegels by any means.
So why don't you dive in, Sam, to the different types of conservative measures and, you know, maybe biofeedback techniques that you use with patients? Because to your point, I mean, in many studies, even in orthopedics, they're not super powerful because either the exercises are cookie cutter, right? And it's not taking into, you know, the comorbidities and, you know, really the individualized model of care, but they're not including everything that we do in PT, right? So exercise, mm-hmm. and I also jump, you know, exercise isn't PT. You know, PT is much more than just simply exercise. You know, there's manual therapy, there's neuro-rehab, there's patient education, you know, there's just so much that goes into it that's so hard to create a powerful study with, because it's just so individualized, right? So why don't you jump in and just talk a little bit about the conservative, you know, absolutely. Options. Yeah.
So I'm early on in my career and I'm continuing to take more courses. I'm always interested in the latest research. The more recently, the courses that we've taken, myself and Dr. Christine Johnson, who is also a women's health physical therapist here at Concierge PT. Where is it going with this? We, you know, I think when we think women's health PT, like you said, it's always Kegels. And then after like a full exam, you know, you may find that it could be that the pelvic floor is too tight, or the pelvic floor is, they're not actually contracting a Kegel, but actually squeezing their bum, or, you know, they're just holding their breath and they're not actually activating any of those muscles. So like Sean said, a lot of it is patient education. And, you know, I think learning how the body moves. So with outpatient physical therapy, I think a lot of it is breathing, posture. When you have a diagnosis like an overactive bladder or pelvic pain, sometimes sitting hurts, or you're just so accustomed to crossing your legs to help hold your pee that you've created now low back pain, tight hips. And then I think these are all things that if you can normalize and fix and lengthen with the use of biofeedback or even like self-massage to your thighs and just sitting up straight. And, you know, I had someone set an alarm for at the top of every hour because she works at a desk. If she's crossing her legs, to uncross them and then sit up tall. And she noticed that over a period of time, she's like, that alarm would go off. And, you know, 5 minutes before the alarm would go off, I would uncross because I knew that it was happening. And breaking habits that people have just, you know, from teenager to adulthood have just carried on. One thing that I do like using is the biofeedback. So we both have the internal and external probes, and it's retraining the brain to see what muscles are actually firing. So I liked the external probes, you know, we'll start like laying down, and those pads are placed on specific muscles. And, you know, someone may be laying down and we find out that that should be a resting position and they're completely clenching and they're making their pelvic floor issue worse. Usually it's pelvic pain. Or we may find out that with those pads on the muscles that we tell them to squeeze and nothing is firing. So that feedback of having someone trained and giving you some visualizations that help activate those muscles. Sometimes it's visual imagery, counting for some people, or even like that the breathing that we do in yoga. But, you know, some people say I would never do yoga, but then slowly incorporating it and they're like, all right, I think I could do this outside of here at yoga, and training the body to move how it's supposed to move. I don't know if that answered your question, Sean.
Yeah, you know, on a tangent. And I think especially for both of you know, it's such a private profession, right? So I think that the number one thing is just rapport, right? So the first thing you need to have is just building up a base level of rapport, I think, with anybody. And I think, you know, as physical therapists, what's nice about what we can do is we get to spend an hour with everybody, right? So we're able to kind of diagnose over the course of that hour and spend the time. Whereas, you know, you're stuck, doctor, hung in an office with a 30 minute time slot or an hour, whatever it is. And you could, I mean, that decision process must be tough because I can imagine going through a million different things in your head as to which direction we're trying to go. So if you could talk to that, you know, even in terms of medications, in terms of imagery, let's talk about that route and kind of what you consider. So let's just pick a diagnosis. So what is the most common diagnosis that you typically see, Sam?
I would say some sort of overactive bladder, some type of stress incontinence that they will think is overactive bladder. Medication hasn't necessarily worked. We find out that it's actually incontinence. I think kind of teasing that out, especially if it is new to the person.
So let's maybe dive into that, Kristen, and just talk a little bit about, you know, that person walks into your office and you can even say, you know, maybe it's a postpartum and then, or maybe it's a, you know, an 80-year-old female, right? So maybe talk about those two cases and considerations for each and how your brain kind of walks through each case and what you do there.
Yeah. So Sam, what you're hitting on with the incontinence, you mentioned overactive bladder. You also mentioned stress incontinence, and this is a really important distinction. And it takes both someone in your position as well as someone in my position to work together to help someone get better. My job is first to diagnose and give the patient as much of an idea of actually what's going on. And oftentimes it's both. Oftentimes there's one that's worse than the other, but overactive bladder means that someone is leaking due to urgency and due to the bladder muscle itself being overactive for various reasons. I kind of liken it to a hyperactive child. Versus stress incontinence is oftentimes a mechanical problem that needs a mechanical solution. And I liken that to something more structural, like someone having, you know, one leg shorter than the other. Until you make those legs the same length or you make up for it structurally, you're always going to have the same problem. The beauty of physical therapy is that it addresses and treats and can cure both. And so it's my favorite thing to start with because I know that most women have both. And it's, like I said, you don't ever, you know, there's no harm in trying physical therapy. What you're alluding to, Sam, too, is sometimes we'll think it's one thing, but it turns out to be another. And there are situations that, you know, I won't get into today, but the diagnosis can be complex. For that postpartum patient, a lot of the nerves have changed. They haven't recovered yet. And in, you know, in the thick of being postpartum, there's a lot that is hard to tease out. What I tell my postpartum patients, especially the ones who are immediately postpartum, is that a lot of things will get better. In other countries, physical therapy is a standard of care for pregnancy. It goes hand in hand with the glucose testing, with all the things that your OB would have done, that PT prescription before and after PT are part of that bundle. It's not the way in this country, but I think it should be. So that's where I would start with the pregnancy issues that kind of arise after or during pregnancy. For the 80-year-old, it's not that different.
Can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
So could you just elaborate too, just a little bit for our audience, just about some of the changes too? So, you know, obviously we know about relaxin and some of the hormones that kind of, you know, peak during pregnancy. Can you talk, you know, it doesn't have to be super specific or sciencey because we want, you know, the layperson to understand it, but talk to women about what changes, you know, it doesn't, maybe not by every trimester, but what changes in their body? Why do you feel like they need, I know what I need PT, but why would they need PT and you know, let's just talk on that just for a moment before we dive.
So backing it up away from the reasons people, you know, complain about that lead them to PT, such as the incontinence or the prolapse, generally speaking, in pregnancy, you mentioned relaxin. There are hormones in your body that prepare your body for pregnancy. This is a good thing, but there are side effects of those hormones that are all natural. And part of that has to do with your joints all loosening. A lot of women notice that their shoe size goes up and sometimes never comes back down. And that's because the joints in all of your body expand and loosen to get ready to let that baby come out vaginally. And you can imagine if you look at kind of the anatomy you start with and the size of the baby you end up with, there has to be an expansion somewhere. And so women will tear in pregnancy, and that's part of what commonly happens. But even with the tearing, it's still not enough space. And the pelvic muscles not only need to be relaxed, but the joints and the bony structures need to be able to separate a little bit. What that means is that during pregnancy and afterwards, there is a lot of pelvic instability. The muscles and joints need to learn to come back together the right way, and physical therapy can guide and support that in a really important way.
Great, awesome, thank you. Now let's dive into the 80-year-olds.
Yeah, so for the 80-year-old, you know, whether you're 30 or 80, a lot of the problems can feel the same and can be caused by the same things, but you have 50 extra years of life and other things that can happen to your body that contribute on top of what your body went through in your 20s and 30s. And so all the more reason everyone's approach should be individualized, but also holistic. And so if people are physically able to, things have changed with the pandemic, but we're looking forward to getting back to a new kind of normal where that threshold for sending someone to a weekly PT sessions can come back down to what it was before. I find that every place now has good protection, and I don't have any qualms sending someone to physical therapy. We're all practicing the measures that we need to keep people safe in the pandemic. So it's more important that these issues get treated at this point. And for the 80-year-old, a lot of times chronic orthopedic issues, chronic back pain, chronic hip issues, knee issues, whether they've undergone joint replacement or not, will contribute chronically to pelvic floor issues. Sam, you talked about the pelvic floor muscles working in concert. They also work in concert with fascia, with ligaments, and with bones and joints. And one thing will affect all the others. And so the more life you've lived, the more life you've enjoyed, the more all of these will add to the stress on your pelvic floor and ultimately pelvic floor dysfunction. And, you know, I tell people it took a long time to build up to this. It didn't happen overnight. It'll take a long time to undo. And that's why I think it needs to be a long-term partnership.
Agreed. I guess another question I had for you, Dr. Hung, is since you were in school for this and now that you're teaching, did you find that there's a growing interest in this? I know you mentioned that in other countries, you know, pelvic floor PT is part of the package of the hospital, like after you give birth, you know, you see your PT. But here in the States, do you find that since you've been in school that, you know, more and more people are starting to specialize in this?
I don't know how many people are specializing in it. I know that we have really robust referral lists now, and we're always learning about new places that do pelvic floor physical therapy because it is a specialized thing. And I think it's grown alongside my field, urogynecology. And what I've noticed between the time that I was in training and now is two things. One, more and more, there are, like you said, more and more people who do this. When I first started out, there were, you know, the two or three places I knew were good and I would send people there. I get patients from all over the country, but all over New England for sure. And being able to send someone to physical therapy closer to their home in Maine, on the Cape, in the islands, Springfield and farther west, it's really important because the other thing I say is the most effective physical therapy is the one that you're actually going to go to. And having people locally is really important. And I do know that there are more and more options now. And that's the first trend. The other trend is that I'm getting more and more patients referred to me after having tried physical therapy. And I think this can be a great thing. And I think this is a great opportunity for primary care doctors to get someone started because there is a wait list. Again, there are more and more PTs, but who specialize in pelvic floor, but the wait list is long. I've heard patients tell me that they've had to wait up to 10 months for a visit. That's how busy pelvic floor PTs are. And so the sooner we can refer someone, the sooner someone can get that referral and make that appointment, the better, because they will often have to wait. When I see someone who's already actually completed the entire course of physical therapy, that allows me to then go to the next step or reevaluate where they've been. I never take anything for granted in what's been done previously, but it is helpful to have tried a few things. And people who've been to physical therapy, I find, are very well educated. They've learned a lot, and that further enlightens and deepens my conversation with them as well.
Great to hear. Well, I know you're busy. I don't know if you have another patient after this. So everything you said has definitely been very informative, and you know, I've learned a lot just listening to you. So this has been great. Sean, you have anything else?
No, you know, I think it's great for our audience just to kind of understand what role the urogynecologist plays in women's health in general and how the two professions interact. I think that's really important for the layperson to understand. And then just like kind of that referral tree. And I know we always ask questions about surgery, and I think, you know, it's important for people. There's always, I feel like, a layer of fear with surgery that, you know, I think needs to be ameliorated and it needs to be talked about and discussed, because if that can really, and I wanted to kind of ask you about your decision tree as to what goes in, you know, we talked about it a little bit, but, you know, when do you know somebody's ready for surgery? And I know there's a million different conditions and everything, but is there something you say, okay, this person is ready? Like what is that checkbox in your brain that says, okay, I need to operate?
So as I've mentioned, it is a two-way street and it's very much a partnership. It's not something that I will tell someone you need surgery and now you're ready for it. I take my cues from the patient. And so when people come in, they tell me, I ask them, and I think a big part of me understanding is just listening, not just to what they say, but what they don't say. When people have come to me having tried a bunch of things, I'm their second, third, fourth opinion. MS General, we get a lot of referrals. We get a lot of complex cases that other doctors don't know what to do with. And we have the honor of, you know, sometimes starting over and sometimes trying new things. And it's always a combination. So it goes back to being highly individualized. Now, generally speaking, someone's ready for surgery when A, they have to be a candidate for it. And what that means is they have a condition that surgery of some kind could actually help. That has to be one of the options, but also in terms of their other medical issues, their overall general life and their expectations and their goals of care, all of that has to make them a candidate for surgery. And that's something that I can help them determine because that's where my expertise is. That all being said, and assuming all of that is true, they are a candidate for surgery with all that entails, it then goes back to the person, to the woman, to say, now I'm ready for surgery. So when people ask me, when should I get surgery? The simple answer is when you feel like you're ready for it. How do we determine that? That is what their priorities are. That's what their concerns are. Some people want to skip to surgery because they know that they don't have time for trying all the various other options that generally could come before surgery. Other people want to avoid surgery for various reasons, either medical or personal, and or logistic. They don't have time to take time off work, and they want to try everything but surgery. And then I find a lot of those people do wind up with surgery just later. Everyone has to go through their own path and be ready for it, whatever that entails. And sometimes that's just the fear of surgery. You mentioned that, Sean. There's a lot of fear. So-and-so had a neighbor who had some type of surgery and it had a bad outcome. So-and-so had the same condition on the surface, seemingly same condition, had surgery and had a bad outcome. And so, you know, that's where I really need to listen to my patients and hear where their fears are so that I can address and further inform their fears. My goal isn't to take away their fear. My goal is to understand it and then give them the information they need to decide whether they want to hold on to that fear or not.
I think that's great. You know, I think the pathways are so important. And, you know, it's so tough because we deal with so many different types of people too, right? So socioeconomically, insurances can go into it too. And, you know, so there's economic challenges potentially with taking work off with surgery, you know, and I think that you can't, you know, and for us too, it's the same thing. You know, people need to put aside time during their week to come in and get healthy. So I think laying out the options, but then also being able to present the best option is truly, you know, to me, what separates the better providers from the providers that are like, okay, you know, here, just do this because this is the pathway, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we've found that, I found that in my own personal medical care and my wife too, is that sometimes when you have too many options, you want somebody to tell you, hey, listen, this is your best bet. Go see Dr. Sam, or just let's just go into surgery. This is what it's going to do. This is your, you know, these are the risks, but this is what our expected outcome is going to be. I think sometimes people want that confidence, but it's not always that easy, is it?
It's not always that easy. I can provide recommendations because people will ask me, well, just tell me what to do.
Right.
You're the doctor, tell me what to do. I hear that a lot.
Yeah.
And so I always back it up one step and say, I can tell you what I think would work the best for you, but I have to fully understand where you're coming from. And I want to make sure we do a full evaluation. And so I can, and again, this is person dependent. Some people want to be told, just give me the plan and I'll do it. I don't even care what it is. I trust you. Other people want to do their own research. They come in with stacks from Google and they have their own ideas and their own stories of what they think is best. And I really think it's a true partnership.
Yeah, that's great. And just before we let you go, in terms of options, right? So, you know, like for the elbow, we've got PRP or shockwave or, you know, different things like that in non-surgical care. When people come into you, you know, obviously we know about PT, we know about surgery. What other options do folks have? Do you have anything? Can you touch on
that? Yeah, there's lots of options. It depends on what the condition is. So prolapse it's a mechanical thing. Things are falling down. We need to put them back up. And PT is certainly a first place to start. A pessary is a device that can mechanically hold things up. It's very safe, very effective, but I liken it to having contact lenses or a retainer. It requires upkeep and it requires maintenance. It's a great option for some who felt like PT was just not enough or want something in addition to PT. It's also a great option for people who are desperately trying to avoid surgery. There's good data showing that people, even when they get a good pessary fit and they like the pessary, 90% of them end up with surgery over the next 2 years. That's retrospective data. But I think that's very telling. It doesn't mean someone should just choose surgery though, because again, the path to surgery has to be individualized and it has to be something that the patient really wants to do. For incontinence, again, there's many types of incontinence. So for incontinence that's due to a mechanical problem, such as stress incontinence, leakage with cough, laugh, sneeze, that is similar to prolapse, mechanical problems require mechanical solutions. For urgency, leakage on the way to the toilet, overactive bladder, feeling like your life revolves around where the bathroom is and when you can go, that I liken it more to a chronic issue such as diabetes. It's something that requires a lifestyle change, and oftentimes physical therapy is the best way to get going on that. And I will tell people, you know, even if and when you get better with PT, you may have to go again in another few years. People get refresher courses. It's like having a trainer at the gym. It doesn't mean you have to see that trainer every week for the rest of your life, but this may not be the last time you see them. In addition to that, or sometimes instead of that, people opt for medications to directly help the bladder be less active. That has a lot of medical considerations, and it's a conversation that I often involve the primary cares and other providers that the patient has as well. And then there are procedures. Procedures include different types of nerve stimulation, different types of injections to paralyze the muscles, and a lot of those have pros and cons that I go into detail with if and when someone is a candidate for that.
That's great. Are you doing any in terms of diagnostic imaging? Is there any base level of imaging that you're doing, or ultrasounding, or is there anything that you do there?
When the situation calls for it, there are different types of conditions that I also treat that we haven't mentioned today that require or are helped by imaging: urethral diverticulums, fistulas, which is an inappropriate connection between two organs. Obstetrical injuries, where people had an injury of the sphincter, things like that. Yes, imaging, but that depends on what the issue is. For people who come in saying, I have, you know, leakage, if they've already been through a lot of things that don't work, then I may recommend looking inside the bladder. That's called cystoscopy, where I put a camera in the bladder. It's in the office. It's a very quick and easy procedure. But at some point, when someone's not responding to the usual conservative therapies, then we want to make sure that there isn't something else going on.
Sure. And I'm sure by the time they get to you too, Kristen, there mm-hmm. have been a layer of imaging techniques probably used prior to, you know, your appointment, right?
It depends on the primary care doctor and what they've done and what the issues are.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Any other questions, Sam?
No, I think Dr. Hung, it would be, you know, I know as someone who isn't fully versed on all of this, listening to this and knowing that a surgeon has taken the time out to explain all of this is a huge wealth of knowledge. So I know I appreciate it. I'm sure Sean does as well. And all of our listeners are very excited to have all of this and, you know, probably rewind and listen to that part again and see if it applies to them or now new conversations that they bring up with their primary care. So I personally want to thank you, and I know Sean does as well, to have you take time out of your day to talk to us about all these different topics.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Dr. Hung. And, you know, I think if one person can just, you know, raise this to their doctor, their primary care, I think this is time well spent. And, you know, we really, really appreciate your time. And hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for asking these important questions. I would love to get the word out to women that it's okay to ask for help, and there are things we can do to help.
Excellent. Thanks for your time again today, Kristen. And have a great week and weekend.
Thank you. You as well. Take care.
Thanks, Kristen. Bye.
Thanks again for joining us for this week's Hooked on Health podcast. Please check out our website and the link below. Whether you're listening on Spotify or on our page, you can reach me personally by email for more information.